Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Friday Center in Chapel Hill, it's Friday, January 16th, 2017. Happy New Year. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for clicking play on the WUNC Politics Podcast. Outside of the nation's capital, the epicenter for partisan bickering may just be Raleigh these days. Another year and obviously more political theater taking center stage already just a few days in. Lawsuits stemming from a December special session are moving forward. These, of course, pertain to separation of powers and really the fight for authority between the legislative and executive branches in our state government. And for his part, Governor Roy Cooper moved this week to act unilaterally and expand Medicaid.
We have to accept Medicaid expansion that is being offered to our state. It will provide us significant investment.
However, there is a state law forbidding Cooper from doing just this. Here to help us digest, understand, and get a little more context and perspective is Rose Hoban, editor and legislative reporter for North Carolina Health News and a former WUNC health reporter. Rose, thanks for being here.
No problem.
All right, let's begin with this call to expand Medicaid. We're going to get into lots of the nitty-gritty of Medicaid. What do you initially make of this proposal or this call to action by our new governor?
You really want to know what
yeah,
I do. My first thought was, why this week? Did we have to do
Welcome
this
back.
This week?
We did. We couldn't have a quiet week in politics
no,
in North Carolina.
No, we really couldn't. Like, we couldn't have a quiet week before Christmas.
Mm-mm.
No. So my first thought was, wow, like, can I say ballsy on the radio?
Yeah, you just did.
Okay, so ballsy political move.
Yeah.
Like, he's really throwing down the gauntlet.
Mm-hmm.
Like, right out of the box.
And it comes in response two, three weeks after the legislature moved to remove, strip, however you want to classify it, some authority from the governor, from Roy Cooper. We're talking about appointment powers and doing away with the Board of Elections. And those are the types of things that are hung up in court cases. But you think this is different?
I would say that this is a four-year delayed gauntlet thrown.
Okay.
Because around this time of the year, in 2013, the newly installed supermajorities at the legislature threw down their gauntlet.
Yeah.
Just as the Affordable Care Act was being implemented. And their gauntlet was Senate Bill 4. You know, you and I both know, Jeff, from being at the legislature, that Senate Bill 1 is usually like rules, and Senate Bill 2 is, you know,
something significant.
Well, No. Senate Bill 2 is frequently like, you know, again, kind of like a procedural thing.
Right.
Then Senate Bill 3, it'll be something significant. So those first couple bills are always like, we're putting our mark down right now. Well, Senate Bill 4 in 2013 was the screw you, Obama bill.
Right.
We, no way, no how are we going to implement Medicaid expansion.
Right.
Nope. And not only that, we're not going to do a state-based health exchange, even though we had spent money on doing it already. And even though, to harken back, now former Governor McCrory and his state budget director at the time, Art Pope, they wrote a letter to the legislature in, I think it was February of 2013, saying, could you slow down, boys, just a week or two? Because what ended up happening, they moved so quick to say no to the Affordable Care Act. And we had already done work. We had already pulled down federal funds. It ended up costing the state $14
million. $14
million
or $14
billion? $14
million. $14 million, okay.
In
Not
money that we
right.
had in money that we had sucked down from the feds in order to build a state-based exchange. Or it was going to be a partner, like, you know, federal state. And if we had waited, I think, like 11 days more, we could have kept that money. but they moved so fast. They were so anxious to make a statement that they, you know, they said no to McCrory from the very beginning, and they said no to Obamacare from the very beginning. And that's when this whole drama about Medicaid expansion or not began playing out.
Right. Okay. So for novice folks and simpletons like me, there's Medicare, but that's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about Medicaid. So out of Obamacare came an option for states that we're going back 5, 6, 7 years now for states to expand.
Actually,
Medicaid.
Out of Obamacare came the requirement for states to expand Medicaid.
Oh, and then some governors opted not to expand.
No.
Okay.
And then there was a lawsuit, and it went to the Supreme Court,
okay.
And it was Chief Justice John Roberts who wrote in his in his decision that states this was that the feds could not compel states to expand Medicaid, so he made that optional.
Okay.
And currently, 31 states have chosen to expand Medicaid.
And we should note, and I think it's interesting.
It might be 32 now.
Okay. But, you know, 2/3 of states in America have chosen to expand. I think one point that is interesting to note, so in Medicaid, in 30 seconds or less, who does Medicaid provide to?
A lot of low-income kids, some of their parents, pregnant women for around 3 months before and 3 months after they give birth. some folks with disabilities, and and one of the big price tags that people don't think about is lots of low-income seniors who tend to be people in skilled nursing facilities, otherwise known as nursing homes, who are poor. They've spent all their money, and the only way that they're going to be supported is by Medicaid. And folks think, well, Medicare pays for that, and actually, no. Medicare does not pay for long-term care.
Right.
Medicaid does.
Okay. Depending on the estimate, there's, and we won't get into the nitty-gritty on this, but can we generally agree that there's somewhere between 300,000 and 500,000 people in North Carolina who are not covered by Medicaid and would be were it to be expanded?
It depends on whose estimates you use.
Okay.
The estimate was higher, 500,000. There's been some revision of the estimates down to about 300,000. But hey, you know, last January, Louisiana expanded Medicaid, and you and I are going to talk about this more. And, you know, they're a much smaller state, and they ended up with 325,000 people in their Medicaid expansion. So the numbers are, it kind of depends on, you know, what ends up happening.
So much of what we talk about on the podcast and as it pertains to state politics is obviously partisan and falls along party lines. So I think it's important to note as we get into Medicaid that you mentioned a couple moments ago, Rose, about the 31 or 32 states that have expanded to include a much larger population of people who are low income and senior citizens and women who are pregnant. Some of the states that have expanded Medicaid include Arizona, did so with Republican Governor Jan Brewer.
She was one of the first ones to go there.
And has since praised Medicaid. Indiana, whose governor at the time was our soon-to-be Vice President Mike Pence. Ohio, Republican Governor John Kasich. And New Jersey, Republican Governor Chris Christie. So I think it's just worth noting that there have been some examples of red, purple, and blue states that have expanded Medicaid. And throwing you on the spot with this question, are you aware of any states that expanded Medicaid and had lousy results or you know, wished they hadn't done it?
No.
None at all?
No.
Okay.
I mean, you would have heard about it?
Right. And I don't recall having heard about it.
No. And, all I do is think about healthcare. And a lot of my brain space is taken up with Medicaid. And you don't hear that. What you hear is things like one of the first flags I saw raised up after the Medicaid expansion started was the Arizona Hospital Association saying, "Oh, thank you, God, this is awesome. You know, we don't have so much uncompensated care. This is a big deal for hospitals. They have a lot of uncompensated care." And folks who say that Medicaid expansion is a good idea, right, they point to the fact that when hospitals have a lot of uncompensated care, they have to jack up their prices. It doesn't really change their costs, but it changes what they charge everybody for what they do so as to cover all that uncompensated care. And then so when you jack up the prices, then that means insurance rates go up. So that means that everybody ends up paying when you've got, right, you know, all those folks who are walking into hospitals. And the hospitals will say to you, we are mandated by federal law.
They have to provide service to
people.
That
law is called EMTALA. They have to see people. They have to provide them with basic care.
And we're talking about emergency departments and emergency rooms being, generally speaking, the most expensive place to get
care.
So our brief public service announcement here is, if you've done it, if I've done it, if our friends have done it, if people are listening, don't go to the emergency room if you can avoid
go
it.
Go to an urgent care. This is why every hospital you know mm-hmm. is starting an urgent care.
Right.
Now, you know, Jeff, not everyone here does, that I'm a nurse. I started my nursing career in a public emergency room mm-hmm. in Washington, D.C. And, I mean, this was before
the Omen's Work.
Yeah, it was 2 years. I still dream about it at night. I'm not kidding.
Dreams or nightmares?
Nightmares,
okay.
Kind of.
Yeah.
And it was when D.C. was the murder capital of the U.S. So I did trauma nursing. And there were days, and there was a private hospital in the district. I remember one day, a patient showed up who had been shot in the shoulder. This private hospital across town, which shall not be named, but has a large university attached to it.
Not associated with our first president. Go ahead.
Not associated with our first president.
Not. Oh, okay. All right.
Okay. So anyway, this guy showed up with a bunch of 4x4 gauzes, like sort of taped to his shoulder. He had, in a taxi.
Oh, Lord.
Basically, he'd gone over to this other hospital. He'd been shot in his shoulder. They basically staunched the bleeding, loaded him into a taxi, and sent him to us. This is why EMTALA was written, right? Because wealthy private hospitals were dumping patients on poorer public hospitals. So EMTALA being that law that requires basic care.
Wow. Okay.
So
go ahead. Sorry.
So these hospitals, they'll point out to you that, you know, part of the reason why they end up having to raise their prices and, you know, do all this stuff is because they're required to provide this basic care. So this is, you know, when Medicaid expanded in some of these states, you were hearing from places like Arizona, Alaska. Alaska is another Republican-led state.
So when it expanded
Medicaid
there, costs dropped. It didn't expand here, and costs either stayed steady or continued to grow? Is that a fair one for one or no?
That's an inference that's a little bit too broad.
Okay.
Because costs in healthcare have just sort of risen steadily. There are some intimations that in the wake of the passage of the Affordable Care Act, the cost curve has bent somewhat. You know, I'm making the little hand motions where instead of my hand going up like at a 45 degree
right.
angle, it's kind of going up at maybe like a 20 degree angle. So the costs have continued to grow. They're just growing a little more slowly. And I think we're seeing that. I don't know. You know what? I'm not even going to say
okay.
that. But in states where Medicaid has expanded, we do see that states end up, in some cases, have net economic benefit because of the creation of jobs and the the fact that folks are now covered. It creates more jobs. It means that states are spending less on uncompensated care.
So there's policy and there's politics. One thing I do want to ask you about, the economic piece of this, setting aside for a moment the costs of Medicaid. One of the things Governor Cooper did this week when he made this announcement that he's going to act unilaterally to expand Medicaid, which is a Hail Mary, is a bit of a long shot,
mm-hmm.
but it's going to lead to another fight. Regardless of all that for the moment, Cooper made this argument that this is an economic move. This is good for jobs in rural areas. Is that at the heart of this, or is that a bit of a sidebar?
That's a really sticky question. Yeah. There are many things. So, late 2014, the Cone Health and the Kate B. Reynolds Foundations co-funded a study looking at economic benefit per county
mm-hmm.
in North Carolina, and they found a lot of economic benefit in counties.
Rural counties.
All counties, but rural counties included.
Okay.
And actually, late last year, just before the election, I think it was like 2 weeks before the election, I covered a meeting that was held down at Campbell U in Buies Creek, and it was all of these advocates talking about Medicaid expansion, specifically in light of the benefit that it would provide to rural communities. And the an economist from the Rural Center calculated that all told to the state, that the benefit would be about $5 billion in economic activity, and $3.2 billion of that would be in rural counties. So we're talking about some big-time economic activity in rural counties that's been calculated as a result of Medicaid expansion. Now, there's folks on the other side of the aisle who would argue with that, but there's been a lot of economists crunching these numbers for a long time, and it seems like they've got a pretty solid argument that there is an economic benefit to expansion.
Okay. Rose Hoban is a guest here on the WNC Politics podcast. She is from the North Carolina Health News website.
Correct.
And is a former health reporter here, was here at WUNC, was a nurse for some 20 years and also a journalist.
I'm still registered.
You're still a registered nurse.
I make sure I keep that license active.
I want to harp on that point that you just touched on, which is the why. So Medicaid expanded in a lot of different pockets in the state, but not here. What's the argument against doing it? Why is there such a fight? Why has there been such a wall built, and why will there be such a fight? We're both anticipating there's going to be resistance here to Cooper on this.
Lawsuits. I mean, the only people who are going to benefit are going to be the lawyers. But
is it policy or is it politics?
Well, it depends on who you ask, right?
I'm asking you.
Well, it depends on who you ask. Okay. If you ask members of the legislature on the Republican side, they'll say it's policy. They'll say that this is part of the reason why, as a country, we run a deficit and that we shouldn't be spending all this money.
Costs are too high.
Overall cost of government is too high. It's too much government involvement. And we do hear this in other states too. When I was doing some research to come in today, there's this idea that, do we trust the feds to actually, because one of the things about Medicaid expansion, right, mm-hmm. is that if you expand right now, like in a state like North Carolina, the feds pay 67% of our costs and the state pays 34%. Or 33, or around the
it's two-third,
it's
two-third, one-third.
Two-third,
split,
one-third. So the feds pay $2 for every dollar that we expend, right? Well, in Medicaid expansion, for the first 3 years, it was free.
It was 100 to zero.
It was 100 to zero. And now it's at a point where we would be paying 5% of the cost.
The 95-5 split.
Correct.
So the state would have to come up with 5% of a pretty big number, either through taxes or potentially through hospitals. To some degree, that was what Cooper floated this week, but
right. Let's not go there yet.
Right.
So anyway, so this is one of the arguments that fiscal conservatives make, is that this is too much government money going to this, and there's been this sort of prevailing argument that, we don't trust the feds to actually be true to their word that they will continue funding these new Medicaid patients at this higher rate. Not the old Medicaid patients. Those guys will still get paid for. Like the traditionally qualified Medicaid folks will still get the 2-to-1 match. And this is like, this 95-5 split would just be for new enrollees.
Right.
By 2020, it would be down to 90-10, and that's where it stays at. In perpetuity. And there's been this, sense that we don't trust the feds, that they're going to keep it at that rate and that they might, screw us later because they then will, revert back to a different percentage, and then we'll be left holding the financial bag. So that's been those have been some of the arguments on the Republican side of the aisle.
Politicians not trusting politicians. That seems apropos
and perfectly reasonable, to be honest with you.
As we hit about 20 minutes in here,
holy cannoli!
Time flies when you're having a great conversation. I want to make sure that we address and chat about Louisiana, because we've noted Arizona and New Jersey and some of these other states. But what is interesting about Louisiana
is the template.
It's another southern state. Mm-hmm. About a year ago, John Bel Edwards, a Democrat, won the executive mansion, and he's mm-hmm. dealing with, I don't believe, super majorities in the legislature. I might be mistaken on that.
No, but, not super majorities.
But there are Republican majorities in Baton Rouge.
Correct.
So we have a fairly analogous situation down in the Bayou where John Bel Edwards moved to expand Medicaid about a year ago. Help me from here, because I don't know much more.
And keep in mind, they had this massive budget deficit.
Okay.
Right? Because they did all this tax cutting and... you know, and so they didn't have the inflow, right? They didn't have the
revenue.
They didn't have revenue. Yeah. Thank you. That's that. So, so it was right around this time last year. It was January 12th. I'm looking at a date here from the Times-Picayune that John Bel Edwards signed an executive order, making people eligible. So, Roy Cooper, right? The clock is ticking. Mm-hmm. He's now governor. We have a new president.
14 days, 2 weeks from today.
Yeah. Right? So how quickly can this happen? It can happen pretty darn quick, right? Because the Obama administration is very anxious to get these things done. Usually what Cooper has proposed is to the mechanism being a state plan amendment, which usually takes months and months and months and months to actually get a state plan amendment. This is really a check the box, send it off to Washington, and they just go rubber stamp it, right? So
play that out, though. Well, then what? If they do that in the next 2 weeks.
They do that in the next 2 weeks. Then the question is, then the lawyers probably will get involved. You know, Cooper's argument seems to be that making these kinds of things happen is a core executive function, and that the separation of powers, you know, that there's a separation of powers and that the legislature has overstepped its bounds, and that he does have, you know, this executive power. And he's going to argue that session law that, remember, we talked about Senate Bill 4
in 2013
is unconstitutional. So there's, you know, so to actually expend the money.
That's where the plot thickens.
Well, that's where the plot thickens, because you need legislative approval for the most part, which is why Cooper is probably going to the hospitals to say, how about you guys levy an assessment on you? And that way you get the Medicaid expansion. Now, you could look at it on its face and go, wow, okay, that's just the hospitals just kind of paying more money out, right? Mm-hmm. But the flip side of it is that they'll probably get more money in.
Right.
So it might end up just being a wash for them.
Sure.
The question is, there's the political, you get back to politics, it's a little political problem. You know, the Hospital Association used to be a big player at the State House. And in 2013, I wrote a story about how the Hospital Association and hospitals in general, you know, had been getting this kind of constant haircut by the legislature. They've had more assessments, and the legislature has held things like them losing, because most of the hospitals in the state are not-for-profits. So when they sell stuff in their gift shop, for example, they don't charge sales tax. And this is a big deal for them. And when they buy stuff, when they buy supplies, they're not charged sales taxes. So this, you know, at a place like Carolina's health system in Raleigh, in Charlotte, that we're looking at like $40 to $50 million a year it's worth to them. Well, so say they decide to play ball with Cooper. Then will the legislature turn around and say, sorry, we're taking away your sales tax exemption? Or we're going to eliminate the certificate of need suite of legislation that, you know, kind of controls competition in the state? Or, you know, will the legislature then turn around and exact a political price from the hospital association? So, you know,
that's the politics,
and
not the policy.
That's
of
the
it,
politics.
Right.
And you saw that played out in the very terse, very neutral press release that the Hospital Association issued on Wednesday after Cooper made this call. Like, you know, we think this should be done in a bipartisan way. And it was very, very carefully worded.
Right.
So, you know, there are a lot of moving parts to this.
So always looking and regularly looking for glimpses of bipartisan negotiation work. Is there any indication to you, you know the players pretty well, do you anticipate Roy Cooper having any allies from across the aisle on this, any at all, within the legislature?
You know, that is a question I'm not even willing to go near. Who knows?
Who knows? There are a lot of them. Republican caucus is big.
I think that there are some Republicans within the caucus, and I think there's differences between the two chambers. You know, so you could ask that question for the Senate and ask that question for the House. I think there's some House members. What I'm hearing out there is that there are some House members who are sort of looking at, like, okay, so here we go. One of my favorite health economists, Don Taylor, over at Duke, day after the election, I called him. And, yeah, he's on my speed dial. I'm on his. So, like, my name just pops up on his phone. So the conversation went like this. Hey, what do you think? Well, and his response was, the dog caught the car. The dog finally caught the car.
Right.
So now, you know, we've had the, you know, Republicans in Congress saying we're going to repeal.
Right.
But we don't have a replacement plan.
Right.
Right? And they've been talking about Medicaid block granting. That's a whole nother ball of wax.
Right. That's a different podcast episode.
That state Republican legislators are waking up and going, holy bloop, 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 bloop.
Right.
This could be a huge mess on our hands if we block grant Medicaid. So, you know, I think there's some Republican lawmakers who are sort of going, oh, golly, now it's all in our court.
Yeah.
And, you know, what happens if you now have 20 million people out there in the rest of the country? I'm not even talking about North Carolina, you know, who have health insurance. And they're getting subsidies to pay for that. Like in North Carolina, 92% of the people who get Obamacare insurance get a subsidy.
Interesting. In the effort and I guess being aware of time and being aware of not going too long here, would love to hear from your crystal ball in terms of not specific to Medicaid, but are there particular things, and I will not ask you to make any declarative statements or guesses. Give me one or two things that you're looking ahead to in this long session, which begins in a few weeks at the General Assembly, as it pertains to health. I'm totally throwing you on the spot here. And if you don't have nothing to say,
we can... And listeners, you are not seeing the facial expression
she's not
that
happy.
I'm making.
She's not happy with me right now.
So here's the thing that I've been telling people for the past couple of years.
Because you've been thinking about this, right? That's not...
I think about it all the time.
Right.
What I've been telling people for the past couple of years, I've stopped making predictions. Because with this legislature, every prediction just, I'm wrong. I'm always wrong.
Yeah.
I feel like the worst weatherman ever. because, you know, like, so you and I yesterday on the phone, we talked about paid family leave.
Mm-hmm.
I was quipping to you that I've been spending the week cleaning out my office and sort of putting my files in order in anticipation of a very busy and active year.
That's a good word for it.
At the legislature. So I want sort of to know where things are, and I've been just reorganizing my office. And I thought that this would be I get to throw away lots and lots of old files. And as I was going through, I was like, paid family leave. There was an effort on this in 2006. Whoa, it's back, right? Like, and I, you know, and there's data out there to show that maybe there's an economic benefit. Okay, well, I'm not going to throw away that file. There's so many things out there that could be happening. I've heard from some folks like, let's perfect the whole thing on autism insurance, right? Because there's still a lot of people who are left out of that.
Sure, right.
So that's an issue. You know, there's a whole slew of issues, and frankly,
There's a lot lingering.
There's the whole mishigas of the child welfare system that came up last year. You know, two major. A federal review and a private review, both showing that our child welfare system is deeply verklempt. And we have legislators who are coming back from both sides of the aisle. Tamara Berenger, who's a Republican right. from Kerry, who has been just talk about a bone. You know, she is like a dog with a bone shaking that thing.
Yeah.
And she just wants to, you know, make the child welfare system and the foster care system better. Tommy Tucker is, you know, right with her there.
Fellow Republican.
Yeah. He was a foster kid when he was a teenager. His parents both died when he was a teenager. Mm. So, you know, so these are folks who really feel strongly about these issues. So they're like, they're gonna work on that one. There's a whole slew of issues out there, but who knows what they're gonna end up being? Because my fear. So some of these issues are really big, like what's happening in the mental health system, right? We still have ED wait times, you know, through the roof.
Emergency department.
My concern is that the politics are going to supersede policy.
Across the board? Predominantly.
Because of these big fights. Yeah. How big are the fights going to be? How deep are people going to dig their heels in? And we do have some really outstanding issues. The child welfare system is a hot mess.
Right.
And, you know, these are children's lives at stake. Are the political fights going to end up completely eclipsing these very necessary policy fights?
Right.
And that's the question.
And doesn't grind things to a halt.
And that is the question that I have about this current session coming up. I really just don't know the answer to that.
It's going to be very interesting to see.
Interesting. May you live in interesting times.
And there will be much more to talk about. I will table it there for now. Rose, this was great. Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
That's all for this edition of the WUNC Politics Podcast. Feel free to share the episode on Twitter or Facebook. Share feedback. Drop a question there as well. And you can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Keep yourself up to date with all the latest political stories at our website, wunc.org. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Enjoy the snow. Have a safe and warm weekend.